Welcome to Money and Racism, the podcast that delves deep into the intersection of finance and racial disparities. I'm your host and money EQ specialist, Dr. Joe Burns. I'm here to guide you through a series of thought-provoking conversations with people of color that aim to uncover the intricate relationships between money and systemic racism. Whether you're curious about the subject, seeking insights, or ready to join the fight against systemic injustices, money and racism is your space to learn, discuss, and take action. So, join us every week as we engage in free-flowing conversations that challenge the status quo and encourage critical thinking. Together, we'll work towards a more equitable and just financial world. Today's episode, we have Michelle Hayward. Dirt road born and raised in rural South Carolina, Michelle Hayward's one of five children and was known for being quiet, unlike the confident leader she is today. She's not your typical tech startup CEO. Michelle may appear as an extrovert, but she's actually an ambivert at heart. And while she hated coding in school, she loves math and its endless possibilities. Michelle is the founder and CEO of Positive Hire, a company that is revolutionizing recruitment and retention by matching diverse talent with companies that align with their career goals. Positive Hire's SaaS platform, PH Balanced, teaches construction engineering companies how to use a data-driven talent marketplace to retain and develop underrepresented employees. Michelle is dedicated to making a positive impact on the world of STEM by creating equitable and inclusive workplaces where everyone has the opportunity to succeed. She holds a BS in civil engineering and an MS in industrial management from Clemson University and has experience as a construction project manager in the energy sector, providing her with a wealth of technical knowledge and expertise. Hi, Michelle. I'm so excited to have you here today and talk about what you want to talk about. Like, I don't want to spoil it for anybody. I do that sometimes. I'll steal people's thunder. But I'm just super excited that you said yes to this conversation. You bring such a wealth of knowledge and experience from your lived life experiences. And just so excited to have you on here today. So thanks for saying yes. And thanks for being willing to talk to me about this.
Absolutely. I'm excited too. So I won't give anything away yet.
So aside from your bio and all the formal part of us, what are some, I guess, other things that you want people to know about you or just kind of what you're like really passionate about, especially when we're talking about this conversation of money and racism?
One of the things that I'm passionate about, which I think surprises so many people, is really about, for Black people specifically who come from chattel slavery, is ownership of their land. And the reason why I'm so passionate of it, my mother tells the story throughout her family, how one of her grandfathers had like 1,000 acres of land and how he divvied that out among his sons. And so we aren't sure what happened to that land. But even from her father, he had 100 acres of land that he split out, not equally, but he split out among his 7 children. And so as we look at how, at least my grandfather, one Black man in South Carolina, amassed up 100 acres of land, you know, who was born in the early 1900s. And so for us, meaning my immediate family, my siblings and I, we talk about land ownership in a different sense because we get to inherit that, not from just our parents, but from our grandparents and what it really means. And so I don't share that often, not that it's not important, but I found that a lot of people that as they did the Northern migration from the South to the North, there's land that the family has lost because nobody paid the taxes on it. They didn't realize nobody had taken it over. And I think it's really important that we talk about whether it was an acre or 20 acres, is it still in the family and how do you maintain ownership of it? And so that is something that I wanted to share just specifically around this conversation. Then the other part of this conversation is I'm one of 5 children for my parents. And that surprises people like, oh my God, that's a lot of children. I'm like, it's 1 more than 4. If you tell somebody your parents have 4 kids, they're okay with it. But for some reason saying 5, it's like, oh my God, that's a lot. And like your parents come, oh, well, they come from a family of 7. I was like, okay, whatever. So it's always funny to me when I say 5, but 4 is acceptable, 5 is not.
I get that. I'm 1 of 5 as well. And people are like, oh, you got a big family. I'm like, is 5 really that big? I know much bigger families, but okay, that's cool.
Our parents' generation, like, you only have 5 kids? What are you going to do with the rest of the farmhand?
Right?
Now it's like, it's like, oh my God, how do you do it?
And that's funny. But I want to go back and touch too. I know this is the conversation piece we were starting to talk about, but I think this is fascinating because I didn't know this about you, about land ownership and this history in your family. That's crazy. I've done a lot of reading on when we talk about money and racism, and it's kind of what started me down this journey of this whole conversation was around what the financial industry was like, what land ownership was like at the end of the slavery period. It's the quote unquote, you know, when the blacks received their freedom, if we can even call it that, at the end of slavery. So that's crazy that like your family, you had so much land because that's almost unheard of.
Exactly.
And then to pass it down, which is really cool.
There's one other black woman. She's actually from Texas. And she tells a story. It's either her great, I think it's her great grandparents. They have 100 acres of land in Texas. I want to say around the Corpus Christi area. And they have their family reunions and everything. And she shared it. This was back when Periscope was hot. And we were in a community together. And I really bonded with her on how much her family celebrated how her grandparents or great-grandparents amassed that amount of land. And they keep it in the family because they understood how difficult it had to have been back then to be able to amass that. And they kept theirs together. Like my grandfather divvied out. They keep theirs together from what I can remember. So there are others out there like us. I don't think we talk about it as much, but it's an important part of our heritage and history. Or maybe they did get their 40 acres and there were some black people that got their 40 acres and a mule and they had to leave it or they were murdered for their land. And so there are definitely stories to be told about land ownership. And then the sadder part is sharecropping. So my dad's side of the family is sharecroppers. And that was very telling. And my grandparents were sharecroppers and how hard they had to work to get their land. My grandmother, we just buried her. We just had her funeral the first Sunday in December. She was 94 years old. And so it was really interesting to still go down there and see as a road that says Hayward Town. Like that's where my dad's side of family, where they lived together, they farmed together, they bought their land together as a cohesive unit. So it's very interesting. Same thing for my mom. It says Chapel Town Road. So you don't always know if you're not from an area. Well, oh, it must be nice to have a road named after you. But for both my maternal, fraternal sides of family, those roads are really about the lineage, is about land ownership. And the reason why it's called that road is because of the people that lived on it and owned the property, not all of it, but a good portion of it. So that was the other part too. So it's interesting to have my parents, both sides of the family, have very roads with family names on it going to our family property.
That's fun. I would call it the little town, the town I grew up in. It's kind of now it's a mass suburb of like Salt Lake City in Utah. The street I grew up on was in the books, in the address books. In Utah, everything goes by the numbers, right? Everything's a numbered street. But in the books, some of them have names. And it's kind of the same thing where I grew up. The street we lived on was called Burns Avenue because my family used to own all the land right there. Then, you know, kind of like this time went on, kind of got partitioned off and sold off and whatnot. But yeah, that's a little fun history about you. That's fun to know. A rich history there that sometimes is forgotten. Or, you know, if people don't hand those stories down, then nobody really knows what's going on, right?
Absolutely. See, we have stuff in common. Yeah, we have to talk about this.
Yes, we do. Again, the whole conversation around land and all that is very fascinating to me. And someday I'm going to have a guest on here that's going to talk about farming. She's super passionate about farming and has a lot more of the things about, you know, kind of land ownership and all that. But that's really cool, Michelle. So many things about you, right? So a rich history of like land ownership, which is for people listening to this, if you start going back and doing history, this is unheard of. Even the sharecroppers, right? Because that was the white communities. I want to say olive branch, but that's being too nice to them, right? To say, hey, listen, you can come, you know, basically still be slaves on our property for maybe ownership later, right? And the sharecropping for almost everybody never really worked out.
Exactly.
It's just a horrible time. Not that there's many awesome times of history. But it was just like an amplified, hey, how are we going to get around the abolishment of slavery? Oh, we'll just present a new system. And with that new system, then we're going to still take advantage of people. The fact that this is like in your history is that's pretty cool as well, right? Where people were able to do that and find some benefit from it because all of the systems were not, they were not hoping for them to win, right? They were hoping for them not to win through all that.
Definitely not.
Has me thinking. That's cool that you have this in your history, and the land ownership is also really cool because I know it's such a big deal. It's something that land ownership can lead to a lot of different opportunities that people you generally don't have, especially for your families and whatnot.
What also brings up, I think, for my family specifically, because we had land ownership, our aunts and uncles then also owned homes because they had land. The other part, I guess, of the story is my maternal grandfather had his own construction company. So he was a stonemason. He built his own house, which is not unusual. He built the family church, but it gave him the ability to run a business, which oftentimes Black people had to do because you may not get hired or you're not going to get paid much anyway. But on the other side of that, my uncles all worked in construction, and I'm the second woman to work in construction for my family. My aunt, who passed along a couple months ago, she actually worked in a family business for a short while, only because my grandfather was sick. Otherwise, he wasn't fond of women working in his business. Yeah, it's a whole other thing. You have to think about the time, right?
Yeah.
In that story was because our grandparents had their own home and the construction, my uncles and aunts, all of them, you were to have your own home as well. And what did that look like for each of them was almost very similar. My uncles built their homes on the land they inherited or purchased. And all three of my uncles at one point in time lived on the same road as my grandparents. So they lived on a road with their name on it. One of my aunts, she lived not too far from there. And then my parents and my mom's younger sister, they moved further away. But again, I'm at my mom's house. It sits on about an acre of land. And then her younger sister, her and her husband built their home on family land as well. And so it's very much to be expected that you were going to build a home on land that you inherited or purchased that was within your family community. My mom and her oldest sister are the only two that literally are not in a family community. My parents decided to live in a small town where we had no family. And the oldest sister, she married somebody that was in the military. So they traveled throughout the world. She was around retirement age. She moved back to the South. She refused to live in a rural area. So that's how she ended up not living, you know, where the family property was.
Yeah.
But it was highly expected you were going to own homes. And I found that is not necessarily for a lot of Black people that I meet in the U.S. It's like, oh, well, you know, I grew up in a city. You don't buy homes, you rent. And I was just shocked. I'm like, what do you mean? I could never. I don't want to share a wall with anybody. I said, I don't have to build up. I can build out. And so it's very common where I live in South Carolina for all the homes that you see next to each other, all family members.
Interesting. It's kind of fun, kind of create what kind of everybody always hopes for, right? Have this little commune of people that you like or care for, right? All living close by and, you know, your neighbors or family or...
I don't know about that. Like, you may not like them because everybody sees everything. And if there's a divorce, let's just say the person that is not in that family is going to be the one that's probably going to move because you don't want... It's a pro and a con in there, but it is very common here to have that happen, especially in rural areas.
That's so fascinating. Again, you know, talking about the land ownership leads to like what you were talking about with your grandfather, right? Yeah. Who had his own business where he can build his own home, right? Because you can't have this stuff if you don't have property. You have to have property somehow. Build your home, build your business and all of that. Without it, that's so important, right? That part of the conversation, which leads me into, you were like third generation construction, right?
Yeah.
You have this passion for STEM. And is that what kind of started it, what your grandfather did? Or how did you get into that?
No.
How does a Black woman from South Carolina get into STEM?
Somebody asked me this question. They remembered me as a kid with like a microscope set. And the question was, did you ask for that or were you just given that stuff? My sister and I were sitting across from each other at this table when the question was posed. And my sister answered for me. She like, oh, she asked for that. Nobody was just going to buy her. And I said, well, I can speak for myself. I asked for all of that stuff. I said it was microscope. It was magnifying glasses. I said all of those things I asked for. And the response was, so you were always a STEM kid. And I was like, you just didn't call it that back then. It was just science. You know, I wanted to learn, understand different things. And so, you know, you had Mr. Wizard on Nickelodeon and different things that we were doing in school that would interest me. My mother, being an educator, she taught public school. She left that and eventually opened up her own daycare. And so she fed that. I'm going to age myself. If you know, you know. Before the internet, when you wanted to buy something and the store was not local, you had a catalog.
Yeah, the catalogs.
Yeah. And August, September, the Christmas catalog would drop. So for those of you that are upset that right after Halloween or whatever, they start decorating the store for Christmas, trust me, the catalogs have trained them to do this Christmas catalogs dropped in August, September. If you know, you know. And so what I would do, because I have four siblings, I would go find a right colored pen for me. And I would go into the toy section and just circle all the stuff that I wanted. And my mom was a fanatical, like Christmas was her holiday. As soon as we started circling stuff, she would be calling JCPenney and Sears or filling out the form and getting our Christmas stuff. And so the sooner I could circle all of these magnifying glasses and microscopes or whatever, I would have that stuff for Christmas. And that's literally who fed into me. And then I was good at math. People like, math is so hard. Like, no, math is real. Word problem's so hard. Like, well, if the bus comes at 6:55 and it takes you 20 minutes to get dressed and 10 minutes to you fix your breakfast and eat, what time do you have to get up? And they look at me, well, I have to get up. I said, that's a word problem. And they're like, nobody ever explained that to me. And so to me, math was always easy, and that helped me as well through school get access. Unfortunately, you either had to be gifted and talented, or you had to have some developmental challenges in order to get access to support. I hope students have more access to things, but that helped me get access to stuff. The limited resources we had here in rural South Carolina, like that's how I got started. It never dawned on me until during the pandemic that I was literally third generation construction. You're like, Michelle, how can you be 40 plus? And I just live my life because the business and my grandfather were already gone when I grew up. And so I hear the stories, but I wasn't there to experience it. So that was the tie that I missed for many years. My family didn't even bring it up. That's why I missed that third generation part for so long.
That makes it a little harder sometimes when the stories we hear, but it's not part of our lived experience. So we're like, okay, sure. You know, until we stop and think about it, kind of like you did. You're like, oh, wait a minute. What is this? Oh, yeah, I guess I am third generation construction. What's up with that? And so it all started with a magnifying glass and a microscope kit for you.
Probably, I don't know when exactly it started. It's the white vinegar and the baking soda and just seeing it and shoot up everywhere. And you got to figure out, oh, shoot, I got to clean this up, right? Or who used all the baking soda? Your mom, you know, my mom finally needed it or whatever. It was those little things. But oftentimes kids are interested in stuff. Parents don't have time or the money to really invest in them. And I was fortunate that my mom did. But also, thinking about the generation that I was in, we were always outside, or I was the last one outside because my mom wouldn't let me out until my hair was done. And I had the most hair. So it's a Black thing, Joe. Don't worry about it. So I would be in the house. I would get to see different shows and stuff. But when I went outside, my younger sisters are twins. They're identical twins. So they played together. My older brother and sister are about 2 years apart. So they played together. And so I'm about 5 years younger than my brother, who's the younger of the two older siblings. And so they didn't want to hang out with me because they're like 10 and 12. I'm five. And then my younger sisters were three. And so they were like, you don't really want to play with your younger sister. So I was left to my own devices. And so that really gave me the opportunity to explore different things because I wasn't necessarily tied to them. My older sibling didn't want me and the younger siblings, I didn't want to hang out with me. So it worked out.
That's fun. That's, I guess, something else we have in common. I'm in the middle of five as well. And the dynamic in my family was kind of the same. The older ones are older than they don't want me hanging around. The younger ones are doing their own thing. So I'm like, okay, what trouble am I going to get into today?
Exactly. And it wasn't necessarily trouble, but we got to do what interests us as opposed to your older sibling telling you what we're about to do or younger siblings pointing at mom and saying, she wants to do it. We don't want to do it. And then let your little sister, like, I didn't have to deal with that much. So those are some of the pros of being the middle child. You kind of toot your own horn and find your way.
There you go. Oh, so true. So I have some questions about your career. Did construction, again, third generation construction, but you have credentials like beyond whatever behind you, right? You went to a lot of school. What was the decision there? Like, you're like, oh, hey, let's just go down this route. Was it one that you consciously thought about? Or was it one where you kind of like fell into it? You're like, okay, I'm going down this route. I kind of like it. So what happened there?
I became a civil engineer at 12 years old. My home state of South Carolina was hit by a hurricane when I was 12. My mom's younger sister and her family live about 30 minutes from Charleston where the hurricane came on land. At that point in time, they lived in a brick home that was about 4 or 5 years old. They were in their home when the hurricane ripped through their home.
Wow.
So they were only laying under mattresses. Luckily, nobody got injured physically, but it was very traumatizing for them.
Yeah, I bet.
As a 12-year-old, I'm looking at the news. I'm looking at pictures. later of their home, trying to understand how can a storm, and that's in air quotes, could do so much damage. And I wanted to understand that. And I remember not necessarily looking in the encyclopedia back then, old school Google, for those who don't know.
Yeah.
The original Google. I remember watching a 60 Minute story about this designer or engineer who had designed and built a home shaped like an egg so that the wind would go around the home and be less likely to damage it. And I was like, oh, how do you build this stuff? How do you design these things? And through engineering summer camps and stuff, I learned about civil engineering. And from there, once I decided to go to Clemson University, it was in-state. It was affordable. The campus was in a rural small town. So I wasn't going to have a car and all of these other things. Coming from a small town, it just made it more accessible and easy for me to digest if I went to Clemson. As a freshman, you have to pick, you know, they show you all the options. You can do tours of different buildings. And I remember going into the civil engineering building and they had this plexiglass house where they did hurricane simulations. And what they would do, they had this huge fan that would simulate the wind of a hurricane. But to show you how strong the wind was, they literally poured down Pepto-Bismol.
Oh.
Because it was pink. It's a plexiglass house, and no matter where you stood, you could see the pink fluid as they angled the fan. And it was teaching assistants or grad students that did the demonstration. I knew this is what I wanted to major in. I'm like, I'm in. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to be a design engineer, a structural engineer. Hated the design aspect of civil engineering. Got through most of the classes. Like, let's just say back then, D was for done. Now they see it's for complete. Is that one class? Like, yeah, I'm not taking that over. The design wasn't for me. And so when I finished undergrad, I was like, you know what? I'm not sure what I want to do. So I stayed for grad school. I didn't want to get an MBA. And I eventually ended up in technical sales, but I was selling for a company in their electrical business unit. So they sold switch gear. Many of you have a panel in your home for your fuse box, if you don't know what I'm talking about, those types of equipment. So they sold things that would be commercially used in your home, but also industrial products. So I was on a product line and I hated it. It's the first grown-up paycheck. At this point in time, I was technically off of my parents' insurance. And so my mom was like, you need a job because you need some insurance. So I took this job and I ended up going to Pittsburgh to attend the National Society of Black Engineers National Convention. This was 2006. Ran into one of my classmates from undergrad. I was like, I'm looking for a job. Her name's Michelle. She's like, you should come by the company I work for. You're going to like it. And so I go over to their booth and lo and behold, I get hired. And that's how I ended up in construction. Back then, the company was called Washington Group International. But in between there, you know, I did a whole lot of other things. I co-opted for a Navy contractor to build aircraft carriers and submarines. I did a technology transfer apprenticeship through the National Technology Transfer Center, which is no longer in existence. It was created to help NASA with technology transfer. I did that for about a year. Then when I finished grad school and when I finally got a sales job, I was tutoring at one of the school districts. I always was finding something to do until when I went to graduate, one of the harder things, and I didn't understand how to leverage this. So if you're listening to this, please don't do what I did. Learn from what I didn't do. I had 2+ years of experience. I had co-op. I did an internship. I forgot one summer at a DOE facility, Department of Energy facility here in South Carolina. And I did about a year technology transfer. And so I literally had about 2 years of experience plus a master's degree. So I wasn't entry level. I was arguing with people to let me take an entry level job. If I had been smart, like, you damn right, I'm not entry level. And so I cut my own salary, right? And so when we talk about money mindset of where we should be, to me, I didn't have the experience and I didn't understand how to leverage all of those experiences. That's a whole other discussion. And so I ended up a few years later after grad school, finishing grad school in construction. First project was outside of Pittsburgh, retrofit for a fossil fuel plant. And for those who don't know, coal, just coal. There's a coal plant, but we call it fossil fuel because it sounds cleaner.
That's crazy. And you are right. Our money mindset, the way we're set up, the communities we come from, the trauma that's passed down, like all that stuff goes into how we see money and how we see ourselves. And you're like, yeah, I did these things, but they're not extravagant. Sometimes we play ourselves down. And so then we don't toot our own horn, right? We're not like, hey, listen, you know, I mean, a master's degree with 2 years of experience, that should bring a hefty salary just to start off with, right? But you weren't seeing yourself that way, which is unfortunate.
It really, really is. Really is.
I don't want to call this part out because I think this leads into some really good discussion here, right? Not to mention that, like, even with that experience and the money mindset you had, like, oh, I'm going to play this down, you're also a Black woman in America who's already at a disadvantage because that's the way the system's set up.
Yep.
Now, thankfully, we're talking more about this and there's people out there advocating like you are. But back then, there probably wasn't a whole lot of that.
No. I remember talking to one of my classmates and I had interviewed with this huge company. I won't call out their name because they had a really great training program. You know, I was trying to figure out what happened. I wasn't getting any responses back. Of course, that's normal today. We know they're never going to respond back to your application unless they're interviewing you or you get hired. And his response was, they don't know what to do with you because you have 2 years of experience plus a master's degree. And I was trying to get into an entry-level training program. And so he didn't know how to advise me because he was like 2 years younger than me. But I went to grad school and he took this job. And even though he was in HR, he wasn't sure how to advise me. And so I had mentors, but still, again, they were maybe 2 or 3 years ahead of me out of school. They wouldn't have known probably how to advise me either. And so it is that gap that we have, especially as Black people, when it comes to professional careers. I think Gen Xers are trying to help millennials and so forth. And older millennials trying to reach back as well to educate, like, hey, position yourself here, do these things, certifications and so forth, and really talk about your skill set and your accomplishments and not necessarily the gaps. But also what happens with the mindset as far as women and Black women specifically, when we look at jobs, you're told to do a really, really good job, right? And it'll speak for itself. Number one, it doesn't. But number two, we also look to be able to do the job 100%, which is not realistic. We really need to look at 30 to 40%. And I tell women in my community that now, you know, we're in their 40s, late 30s, early 40s. And they look like, Michelle, how could I say, if you go in there, you know the job 100%, you will be bored in 90 days. You have to, number one, give yourself room to grow. You will never put a potted plant that fits perfectly in that pot. It's already outgrown it. Why would you take a job when you know how to do everything? But it reduces the risk of our failure. It reduces the risk of us looking bad in meetings if we don't know how to answer a question. But in actuality, it's detrimental to us because companies are getting free experience from us, free labor from us, because we know 100%. We are just learning their processes in 90 days, maybe 180 days. Everything else we're giving away to them for free or at a discount. And so it behooves you not to take a job that you know 100% because they probably are already underpaying you, definitely underestimating you, and it gives you a place to grow. And that is really important. Like, and literally just seeing a post in a Facebook group this weekend, I was like, I don't know. There are two things with this job description I don't know, and I'm afraid to apply. And I'm like, two things? The woman wants to do everything on that job description. That's 100%. Like, can you do this? Can you do that? And there's some stuff when I read job descriptions now, like, oh, they want two people for this job or a job and a half. And I'll tell the recruiter, like, yeah, no. I do recruiting too through my company. But I remember talking to a recruiter after I left construction. She had sent me this job and I'm on the phone with her. And I said, this position's been open for over a year. She was like, yeah, how did you know? I said, because there's 3 positions in here. I said, the only person that's going to ever take this is either somebody that is desperate for a job, or maybe you might get a retiree that's just bored and ain't got nothing to do, but I can tell you they're not going to do all of this work. I said, your best bet is to break this out at least in 2 roles, but nobody going to take this. And so I said, this is just going to stay open. And this is around 2017. And so it's really interesting how you learn to read positions now and refuse to be overworked and undercompensated. And so I highly, highly encourage people to start looking at job positions like, oh, if you can read it, apply. People like, what that mean? If you can understand the systems and software certifications that are mentioned in job descriptions, then you know 30% of the job probably. If you've used some of it, at least had a login for it, you probably are going to be able to do the job. People think I'm crazy. The other side of this, organizations just don't train people. It's like, come in, hit the ground running, run away. It's just certain things I've learned to do and recognize over the years. But long story long, that's what happened.
I like that. And I think the things you're just touching on, right? And I think that kind of pulls in this whole conversation really well, right? The whole money and racism side, because think about it. They're asking for people to come in to know so much. I think us as humans, but different cultures definitely have this thing of like, oh, we have to show up. And I know the Black culture specifically because there's so much going against them that they got to show up extra. And my mentors in this arena have told me lots of time, oh yeah, the Black community expects us to show up extra. And then on the other side, they're not asking to be compensated appropriately, right? Because they're like, oh yeah, I'd have to know 100% of this job. And then they're going to be like, but can I ask for like the top range? I've heard that conversation before. And I'm like, well, yeah, you can. If you know this job 100%, you should always ask for more.
Absolutely. The other thing I think we need to talk about when it comes to racism and money, when it comes to employment part, is the amount of time it takes Black women to get jobs. And so while we may say, oh, you need to ask for money, number one, are they employed? Number two, do they have savings or in a workplace where they are not on a performance improvement plan or being harassed or going through extreme trauma, right? Because sometimes that reduced pay is really for your emotional and physical and mental abuse you may be going through. Like it'll cover not 70% of my bills. I'll pick up some part-time, you know, do some type of side hustle to cover the rest. And then because we know it won't take us 9 months to find a job or a complimentary job or a very similar job, it's going to take us 14 months.
Wow.
And in those 14 months is going to take me to find a job. How much financial stress does that put me in? There will be people that will tell you they lost their cars, their homes. They're selling off a laptop or their computer that they're applying for a job because they need to pay their electric bill. So they're going through all of these things at the same time, but they really, really need to take something. And so I always tell people, do not be afraid to be able to live. And so I understand there's a pay gap, but you have to survive in order to be able to fight back and get fair compensation. And so if that means taking a job, that just means you're going to have to continue to look, continue to interview for jobs once you're able. And that reduces so much stress. And so when we talk about racism and the impact on health, it is the stress that you have. If you've ever been unemployed, you've ever been really stressed financially, that backs into racism, the amount of time it takes, the amount of money you may not be properly compensated. And that's total compensation. That's not just salary. And so we really have to take into account what that really is like in the workplace, in corporate spaces or small businesses as well, when it comes to Black people here in America.
That's interesting that you call out, right? Because I guess I had never thought of it that from that perspective. I know there's issues, you know, instead of like finding a new job in like 6 months or 7 months, maybe 9 months, which is already a stretch if you don't have a job and you don't have very good savings. Right? Because I mean, a couple months will ruin you.
Exactly.
But if it's taking, you know, 50% longer to find a job, that's insane.
Mm-hmm. It is.
That just baffles me. There's the system's that broken that we can find statistics like that says, oh yeah, it's going to take you this amount of time to find what you're really looking for. You know, your suggestion is find something that can help you live so you can find what you really want.
Exactly.
I want to call this out too. As a white man in America, I never had this problem when I was in the corporate space. If I wanted a job, I just applied for it. And it's kind of the same with you. You know, my corporate career was IT. So I know what all those letters mean and all the acronyms they're using. So I should know this job. So I'm just going to apply for it and see what happens.
Absolutely.
It was never a question. And I always got more money than what I was making before. And I always got negotiated, you know, and I have some stories around negotiation and not taking enough sometimes, but I learned quickly. And then I just went back and I got what I wanted.
Yep.
So for me, like, that's where I start hearing stories of this. I'm like, yeah, that's my white privilege at place. Like, I can just go ask and they're not going to push back and they're not going to be mean to me. And my name's pretty generic white, like Joe Burns, right? So I'm not going to, you know, take the hit on the prejudice isn't going to be there right from the beginning, which is unfortunate. But that, what you said, like, really, like, oh my gosh, so much longer. And who has savings to live off of for an entire year? Like, nobody. I mean, there are people out there, but you know what I mean? Like the average American, like you don't got a year's worth of savings to live off of in a way that, you know, is going to be productive for you and your family.
Exactly. And so when we think about corporate spaces, Black people and money, so we talk about the pay gap, but that pay gap is systemic in that when can we afford to retire? Number one, we're getting paid, let's say 30% less for Black women is about 45 cents less per dollar. To a white man in a similar role. In tech is smaller. We get paid like 90 cents to the dollar. I think the last pay scale report I looked at. But what happens overall is the loss of money. So let's say if I'd gotten paid that extra 10%, I'd have been able to afford other things. I could have saved more money. I would have made more off of the stock market, maybe off of my investments or at least my retirement. And so the loss of that 10% over 30, 40 years is huge.
Yeah.
And so when we think about how many millions of dollars that would be, that we don't get use of that money and corporate America gets to keep it or however they utilize it, they benefit from it, but we're still doing the work. And so while they say slavery is over, prove it.
Yeah.
Because you're still getting free labor or discounted labor. And then you're still getting interest on top of that. And so it is systemic, as we say over and over again. If you can and you have the power, you have the bandwidth, you have the money and the time, please negotiate because it does matter. And if you're on the other end, you see the gap, close that gap. There have been managers and so forth where women have told me they've closed the gap or other people have closed the gap for that employee for where they were, but all the years they missed is gone.
There's no retroactive, right, closing of that gap, which is time lost.
For some people, you can't do all of it. And what I mean is, how do you prove for 7 years you would have put it into the stock market and this would have been your return? Will they give you that money back? Usually, at best, they'll go back a certain time period and give you the pay. Of course, the federal government going to take their taxes. I used to be a huge 60 Minutes fan. So there was a story that 60 Minutes did with Salesforce. One of the co-CEOs, and I don't know if their chief human resource officer is still there. I'm pretty sure she's a CHRO, not a chief people officer, wherein she went to the co-CEO of Salesforce like, hey, I think we have a gender pay gap issue. And the question was asked to her, well, how bad is it? And she was like, I don't know. I want permission to investigate it and to resolve it if I find an issue. And she was given an okay to do that. And it was a few million dollars. They retro back to women in that organization. And so the reporter asked the co-CEO, well, if you fix it, why does it keep happening? And the co-CEO was like, we keep acquiring companies. And every time we acquire a company, there's a gender pay gap. And this is just on gender. And so imagine if they went through and did the intersectionality by gender and race, what they would find. And it's really important to understand you're going to see it at different places at different levels throughout an organization. I was just so enamored because this is at the very beginning when I started building out my tech company, like, oh my God, what is this? What data are you looking at? Really just focusing on what this looks like in the workplace. And so what was one key part, one key question, the reporter asked the co-CEO of Salesforce at the time, the reporter asked, why don't other companies do it? And the co-CEO's like, I don't know, but they have the data.
And there it is right there. They know and they don't do. And that's so frustrating.
They're making money off.
Yeah. They're just like, well, cost is less. You know, and one thing I want to go back and touch on something you said, because I think it's important, because it's something I learned, I think, kind of my mid-career before I finally left corporate, right, to create my own business. Negotiations, like how many people out there telling you, hey, negotiate your rate? I didn't know that was a thing for a long time in my career. I'm like, oh, this is what they said they want to hire me at. This is how much they're going to pay me. Okay, cool. I'll sign that offer letter and be okay, cool. I didn't know until, you know, I started doing some research on my own. You can actually push back and say, hey, how about, you know, negotiate. So I just want to call that out for people listening. Like if you're in a similar situation, you can negotiate your wage. You don't have to take what you're given, right? And there's Google or people like Michelle out there who can help coach you through how to get to where you want to go. I didn't know that was possible. I didn't have any clue. I was just like, okay, cool. This is fun. I'm going to get a job. They hired me. They said yes. And so let's go. This isn't less than I want, but let's go at it. Just a little plug out there. If you're not negotiating your rate at your job, it's time to start negotiating it because there's power there.
It really is. We have a lot of negotiation tools and groups. Definitely tap into something to get help. My friend that had been in HR when I was first coming out of grad school, he was still in HR when I went to go over to construction. And I hit him up like, hey, I need help negotiating a salary. And he was like, okay, cool. And he was like, well, it's not an A or a B. He was like, just go through all the alphabets. Like, what are you looking for? And I remembered I negotiated for 2.5 weeks on the salary. And now remember, I was also leaving a sales role to go to a hard salary job. And so I had a base salary back then, it was like 50,000. And then I could make up to maybe 15% per month, I think, or year of my annual. It wasn't a whole lot, but I was like, if I can make 65, I'm not going to take less than 65. That didn't make sense. That's the max I could have made.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he helped me figure out how to negotiate that. And this was 2006. We still had the internet, but I didn't know what the internet was interneting. And I phoned him. And that's literally how I negotiated back then. And I negotiated some other raises internal to the org too. I was there for over a decade. But it's really important that you tap into your network, whether it's a Discord or Slack, Facebook groups, whatever it is, to get help with negotiations. There are a lot of people really helping in that space right now. I've been there. It's been a long time in the aspect of salaries. Still negotiate as a business owner around terms and services. So it never ends. Negotiation is something we do on a daily basis in our lives.
It's so needed, right? And I think just people don't have it. They don't know they can. So yeah, it's much needed. So, Michelle, as we start to wrap up, I'm like, wow, we've been chatting for a bit. I want you to like toot your own horn here for a second, because I know we've talked a lot about your experience through you being in construction and kind of the STEM background. But with what you're doing today, right, you have your own business. What are you doing with that? And how is it helping some of these things we've talked about?
I have an early stage tech startup called Positive Hire. We focus on connecting Black, Latina, and Indigenous women who are experienced. I'm putting that in there because it matters. We're experienced scientists, engineers, and technology professionals to management roles. This is a huge endeavor in that there is a gap between getting this particular race of women to mid-management roles, much less executive roles. And I focus on this area because there's a huge drop-off point for experienced women at about 12 years in. And people don't know this. Everybody talks about a pipeline to get into STEM. They talk about the 0 to 3, but there's another drop-off point. At this point, these women can make a great salary. They have a great level of expertise. And what we really focus on is not telling you to get another degree, please don't, or another certification. You probably don't need it. What you really need is understanding how to position yourself to get the next promotion or to quit that organization. And so we really provide support around leadership development, professional development, whether it's around negotiations, branding professionally. I can't even think all the things. We finding a sponsor, because we often talk about mentors, but a sponsor removes those barriers for you in the workplace, and leveraging a sponsor to progress in your career. So we focus on things that oftentimes you don't see when it comes to Black women, when it comes to Latinas, when it comes to Native American women here, and that are really fundamental that a lot of white men have access to inherently. Because when Bob looks at Joe, Joe reminds me of my younger self.
Yep, 100%, right?
Son, come here. When they look at Michelle and they see her hair, they're confused. And so it really does take a different path, a different plan to really advance. And that's really what we focus on, is helping women overcome those barriers, especially in science, tech, engineering, and math, because it's predominantly white and they're often going to be isolated and the only one, and really helping them navigate that to drive their careers to where they want them to be.
Yeah, I think that's so, it's such needed. That's why I wanted to give you the whole point there where you could talk about it, because what you're doing is so needed. You know, I spent over 20 years in tech. And I can probably count on one hand how many women I ever worked with, meaning that they were also on my team, not that I interact with on other teams, but on my teams. And I think there was one Black woman that I ever worked with who was a member of my team that I actually worked next to. That's a long time to be in an industry and to say, you know, there was one Black woman that was there. She didn't last very long either. She came and left, and the culture wasn't one that she really wanted to participate in, because there was no growth like this, right? You get to a certain point, start doing things, and you're just like, where do I go? If there's not that opportunity, then you're going to lose a lot of really good, talented people who could really drive your organization, but don't, because of the systemic racism. Where, like you said, the favoritism, right? Where the old white dude who's in charge sees me, Joe, is like, oh, hey, you look like me. You remind me of my younger self. Let's promote you up. Let's get you the mentorship, the sponsorship, the all these things that will help you move forward. But like you said, Michelle, right? And they see you and they're like, we don't know. You're confusing. We don't know what to do with you. You don't act like us. You don't respond like us. And so we'll let you exist in your little space, but we're not going to allow you to be seen by everybody else. And it's really unfortunate.
Exactly.
That makes me, again, super excited that you've created what you are and helping really champion these women who need the support because without them, this world is a less bright place, right? And we'll lose out on a lot of, in my mind, what we lose out on, and correct me or add to whatever you want, we lose out a lot of different perspectives that women bring to the workplace that we miss out on that are run by men. A lot of innovation, and history shows us that innovation has been done a lot by women that we don't give them credit for. And it makes my heart sad that we miss out on that stuff because we're not thinking about, hey, we need more diversity. We need more ideas instead of just like, hey, you look like me, so I'm going to promote you.
Absolutely. I would say something else we miss out on right now, that U.S.'s population has declined, especially in STEM technical roles. Women and Black people have been pushed out of these spaces. They don't have enough talent. So baby boomers are retiring. The youngest baby boomers will be at retirement age in 2027. They haven't figured out what they're going to do. They're like, oh, we can use technology. Well, who's going to run the technology? When I look at the U.S. infrastructure, because I'm a civil engineer, we are short 250,000 civil engineers. So everybody's focused on cloud and AI. Where's your water going to come from? Your drinking water in your home. Whether it's highway or public transportation, who's going to maintain that? Who's going to design that? There are huge gaps the U.S. is faced with, and most of it is driven by racism. And so when we talk about racism negatively impacting everybody, if you don't believe us in the next 3 years, you absolutely will. Okay, let me take that back. You may consider it. You may consider it.
I think that's the truth, right? A consideration. Like, oh, hey, does this happen to do with something?
Yeah.
I understand that.
It's going to be a huge driver. And these companies still aren't, they're still going to wait to that 3 years or 3 years after the 3 years I'm talking about when it's critical. You should go hire all the people that we ran off because we had a horrible culture.
Yeah.
Good luck, buddy. Let me know how it works.
Yeah, yeah. That ain't going to happen, right? When things are falling apart, they're like, hey, maybe we should do something about this.
Exactly.
It's unfortunate.
Exactly.
Michelle, this has been an amazing conversation. Someone just caught the last piece of this conversation. What would you hope they get out of it?
Dig deeper. When you think you know the reason behind an issue, dig deeper. Racism's probably tied to it, whether it's being able to cash a check and people like, oh, it's a fake check at a bank. How many times is that still happening? To you actually having even, and this is something we didn't get into, but higher utility bills in poorer areas. There's always a tax. And so when you think dollars aren't going as far, poor people's dollars don't go as far. Marginalized people's dollars don't go as far. Racism is in everything that's here in the U.S. on levels you would not believe. And so I ask you to keep asking questions to better understand those systems and those processes and what's really driving them.
I like that. Because I'm a questions guy too, right? I always ask why, where is it?
Keep asking why.
And through my journey of all this, right? It's like, I used to ask, oh, is that racist? Of course it is. As I've deconstructed my own white privilege and all that, it's come down. Now I'm like, okay, I asked the question a little differently. I'm like, how is that racist? Right? Because at the core of it, it's always there. So
absolutely.
Michelle, thank you so much. This has been a pleasure. Like, I appreciate so much you being on here, having this conversation with me today. And I hope people listening got something out of it. If somebody wants to connect with you, what's the best way they can get a hold of you? Like, if they're like, oh yeah, Michelle, I love your company, Positive Hire, and this passion you have for helping this demographic of women, how can they help support you and connect with you?
The best way to connect with me is on LinkedIn. People are like, really? Yeah. So if you want to connect with me on LinkedIn, I'm Michelle with one L. And so come over, just say you heard me on the Money and Racism podcast with Joe, and let's connect.
Awesome. I love that. I love that platforms are like that, because a lot of times I'll just tell people the same thing. I'm like, hey, just LinkedIn, send me a message, and then we'll connect that way. It seems easiest. It doesn't get lost either, which happens sometimes in my email. Well, awesome. Well, for all those listening today, I appreciate you listening and supporting this podcast and, you know, listening to this conversation. It's why we do it, to have these kind of conversations and unveil, you know, more of how we see racism affecting, and especially how it affects the bottom line on money and people's finances and their way of being in life, which is really the goal for us here. So appreciate you listening. Until next time, we'll be back. Thank you for joining us on Money and Racism. We hope we left you with something to think about. If you like the conversation, make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget, please leave a review. To find out more about the psychology and emotion of money, visit www.josephmburns.com. And if you or someone you know would be a great guest for the podcast, email me at podcast@josephmburns.com. Together, we'll work towards a more equitable and just financial world.